Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker. Right here on, let's see, April the 12th, 2014. And it's a very warm day. Well, not hot, but it's up about, going to get about 70s, but we're going to get some rain, I think. But real nice day out there. Now, today, Saturday, I'm going to just put on a few things that I've dug out of the closet over here and stuff that you probably have never heard or haven't heard for a long time. So get ready and get set. Don't forget P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And let me take you back in time. Let's visit Sinclair Lewis. Remember him?
We want work!
We want work! Sometimes Hollywood mirrored the Great Depression. Other times, it denied it. But behind the scenes were people who used the power of movie making to manipulate Depression politics. 1934, an election year. In Washington, President Franklin Roosevelt, architect of the New Deal, offered hope and unleashed powerful expectations. America was torn between those who said Roosevelt was going too far and those who said not far enough. In California, one man, a writer, a socialist, a candidate who had never held public office, proposed to take the country further than Roosevelt would dare. 1934, the year Upton Sinclair promised the nation that he would end poverty in California.
Everywhere you read about the destruction of crops. I remember the story of almost a quarter mile long pile of oranges as high as your head, and they'd throw gasoline up over it and set fire to it. And that outraged me. That filled me with rage. And it continues to fill me with rage. We were hungry. And you think, God Almighty, what's the matter? Where's the sense in this circumstance?
There's no excuse for poverty in a state as rich as California. We can produce so much food that we have to dump it into our bays.
Upton Sinclair was a world-famous writer and socialist. His 1906 novel, The Jungle, exposed unsanitary conditions in the meatpacking industry and led to America's first federal meat inspection law. Sinclair had written 47 books attacking powerful industries and institutions. Hollywood, the press, the church would not forgive nor forget his attacks.
When I first came into the socialist movement, we had our wonderful dream that we held, a perfect and complete democracy achieved overnight, and that was lovely to talk about. But in the meantime, we had a set of immediate demands.
The Socialist Party of America had campaigned for national unemployment and health insurance and old age pensions. Socialists believed capitalism was doomed, and they advocated government takeover of private industry. But in the depths of the Depression, Sinclair feared that people could not wait for the socialist dream. With the elections of 1934 coming up, he switched to the Democratic Party. His plan, to become governor of California.
I have been asked to stand as a candidate at the Democratic primary and to put before the people a program to end poverty in California.
It was Upton Sinclair who gave me the real stimulus going into the direction of the political side of what the kingdom of heaven or earth should be like.
We needed a voice. We needed somebody who would rally the people. And he did present a program.
To promote his program, Sinclair wrote a 60-page book predicting his own election. His plan, EPIC, End Poverty in California, called for the state to turn over idle factories and farms to the unemployed.
There was so much good land in California that wasn't being farmed, so many factories that were empty and silent, and so many able people who could have worked those farms and factories. And we just thought of the waste.
Sinclair predicted that a takeover by the unemployed would meet strong opposition.
Get it!
The whole power of vested privilege will rise against it, he wrote. They are afraid the plan will put into the minds of the unemployed the idea of getting access to land and machinery by the use of their ballots. The EPIC plan was inspired in part by California's cooperatives, communities where the poor and unemployed bartered goods and services. In 1934, California had 176 cooperatives. Sinclair proposed a statewide system of cooperatives based on production for use instead of production for profit. He believed it would ultimately put profit-making enterprises out of business.
We do not intend what is called subsistence farming. We mean mass production under modern conditions. The land workers are to have the best land and the factory workers the best machinery. And they will be able to produce great quantities of wealth and to make comfort and plenty for themselves.
Life in the cooperatives was romanticized in the Hollywood film Our Daily Bread.
Hey, Carpenter! Yeah? Look, I'm a stonemason. I'll build your fireplace and you'll set up the framework for my house.
Okay. These stones have got me licked.
Well, I don't do so good with wood myself.
Our Daily Bread was the brainchild of director King Vidor. Karen Morley played the female lead.
It was not the kind of part I really was very interested in because it was a goody-goody lead, and I was much more interested in playing women who died or killed people. King Vidor was a very musical person whose films always, you can see, are similar to music. And the climax of Daily Bread was set to music by metronome. When we shot those scenes, there was a metronome going for us all the time. I had no idea what a co-op was, and I didn't know whether it was a good idea or not. But I think that King, who was a conservative person, had an idea that people should just get together and help each other.
Much to Upton Sinclair's surprise, his campaign took off like wildfire. He traveled the state promoting the EPIC plan. Within weeks, his book, I, Governor, was the fastest-selling book in California. The bumblebee became the symbol of his army of volunteers. Hundreds of EPIC clubs formed the heart of the campaign. EPIC supporters published a weekly newspaper with a circulation of 500,000. They ran EPIC rodeos, drama groups, picnics, and sewing bees.
These billboards sprouted all the way around. It was quite spectacular, and you couldn't help spending time reading each one and going from one to another. I thought it was very hopeful because it meant change, and there are lots of things about California and life as we knew it that weren't totally satisfactory.
EPIC meetings were big mass meetings in those days. It was amazing the crowds that he drew. And he depended on the people for his money. So people who had 10 cents contributed 10 cents.
One of the things that I
hadn't expected was to see how many older people were there. Now, they were like everyone else, looking for something better. And, of course, in those days, older people had no safety net.
There would be 5,000 people inside of the auditorium, its full seating capacity, and there might be 4,000 or 5,000 people outside trying to get in.
When I went out on the warpath in the Depression of 1934, I've never forgotten the first meeting at which I spoke in the big hall up in San Luis Obispo. And when I got through telling our epic program of production for use, the men crowded around me and they said to me, "Mr. Sinclair, what are we going to do? We haven't got food to feed our families next week." And that was a condition in California at that time. Well, we threw an almighty scare into the minds and the hearts of the people who were running this state.
The summer of 1934 was a season of protest. New federal laws supported the right to join unions, and across America, a wave of strikes tested the New Deal's commitment to labor. In San Francisco, striking longshoremen had closed the port for 2 months. Violence erupted when police broke through strikers' picket lines. 2 men were killed, more than 70 injured. Within hours, California's governor, Frank Merriam, declared a state of emergency.
Forbearance to the striking longshoremen in San Francisco has passed the point of common sense and good citizenship. I have ordered the National Guard of California to move into San Francisco to safeguard life, to protect state property, and to preserve order.
Labor leaders believed that Merriam had called out the Guard to break the strike. In support of the longshoremen, more than 100,000 union workers walked off their jobs calling for a citywide general strike. San Francisco shut down. People began to hoard food. The Roosevelt administration was now torn between supporting or condemning the general strike. New Deal Administrator Hugh Johnson spoke for those who felt that labor had gone too far.
You are living out here under the stress of a general strike. Now the right of dissatisfied men to strike against a recalcitrant employer is inviolate. But the general strike is quite another matter. That is a threat to the community. That is a menace to government. That is civil war.
After 4 days, workers called off the general strike. Longshoremen and ship owners agreed to arbitration, and the city came back to life. For many, the strike was a warning of the power which the New Deal had placed in the hands of ordinary working people. And troops on the streets of San Francisco triggered fears that the country was on the brink of revolution.
In addition to riflemen,
moviegoers across America saw alarming reports of the general strike.
Also, the police have organized the only mounted gas squad in the world. They've been ordered to round up the Reds, the radical agitators blamed for the virulence of the strike. They're out to comb the railroad yard, to rout out nests of communists hiding in empty boxcars. That gas will drive them into the open. Yep, there's a bunch of them now, dodging the stinging gas clouds. The entire waterfront.
The Democratic primary was just 5 weeks away. In this volatile atmosphere, Upton Sinclair's radical ideas alarmed mainstream Democrats. At a Hollywood luncheon hosted by Warner Brothers, Democratic National Committee Chairman James Farley was asked to alert Roosevelt that Sinclair could win the primary. Farley told Roosevelt, "Everyone out there wants you to come out against Sinclair." Roosevelt decided to watch and wait. By the end of August, the number of epic clubs had grown to 1,000.
It was very exhilarating. We were doing something on a low level, door-to-door meetings and stuff like that. But we were all very, very excited. We thought we were going to not change the world, but to help California and help people.
Epic supporters stepped up efforts to recruit new voters. By primary day, there were 350,000 new Democrats. For the first time in California history, Democrats outnumbered Republicans. To widen his support within the party, Sinclair selected Sheridan Downey, a mainstream Democrat, as his running mate. The slate was known as Uppy and Downey. August 28th. Epic triumphed over traditional Democrats. Sinclair won with 436,000 votes, more than all the other candidates combined.
We mean that California shall be behind President Roosevelt in his effort to give the New Deal to the whole nation. Ours is a democratic plan. We are resting upon the consent of the entire people, and we expect to get it.
Former socialist Upton Sinclair was now the Democrats' nominee for governor of California.
The showing of Upton Sinclair in the primary was so magnificent. It so far exceeded even our wildest expectations. It suddenly became apparent to us that this was for real, that here was a chance to elect Sinclair.
Times are truly coming. All business will be humbled, and we'll give all poverty the air. If this epic plan is phony, then the rest is all baloney. So vote for Downey and Upton Sinclair.
Three weeks before the election, moviegoers in California saw these newsreels on the governor's race.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am the inquiring cameraman. All day I travel around California, the highways and the byways, the downtown districts, the residence districts, the factory districts, all districts, all for the purpose of digging out voters of California to express their views for your edification. Remember?
These newsreels would become one of the most controversial elements in the campaign.
Place the camera and microphone. If they seem awkward, bear with them. I don't rehearse them. I'm impartial. I thank you.
Would you mind telling us who your favorite candidate is for governor?
Sinclair.
Well, have you made a study of his plan?
Yes, I've studied a little bit. Some of them are rather radical, but I think they'll be modified when he gets into office.
I see. Well, now, listen. Do you really believe that he can end poverty in California?
Well, no, I don't think so, but... I don't know what to say about that.
I'm going to vote for Merriam, because I want a job. And if you drive all the capital out of the country, who's it going to pay us?
And you think, then, that Merriam would be the safest for us all?
Absolutely. There's no time to trade horses in the middle of the stream.
Well, Mr. Sinclair, I have something new, that new epic plan. I think it's time that we should try something new out again.
Do you think that's the final word?
I don't know, but I'm willing to take a chance on it.
Now, Mr. Skinner, just who are you going to vote
for? I'm going to vote for Merriam, because I need prosperity.
An article in Variety stated that the newsreels were produced as part of the anti-Sinclair campaign.
I just graduated from school last year, and Sinclair says that our school system is rotten, and I know that this isn't true, and I've been able to find a good position during this depression, and I'd like to be able to keep it.
I'm going to vote for Upton Sinclair.
Will you tell us why?
Upton Sinclair is the author of The Russian Government, and it worked out very well there, and I think it should do here.
The New York Times reported that the anti-Sinclair newsreels were created by Hollywood film crews in a campaign led by Louis B. Mayer and MGM.
The movie industry was a considerable political force in California at the time, and to have the backing, if you're going to run for district attorney or if you're going to run for governor or mayor of a local town. He wanted to get the backing of one of the big companies.
Of all the studio chiefs, Louis B. Mayer was the most active in the Republican Party. He had risen from immigrant poverty to achieve the American dream. Mayer was a staunch patriot who chose to celebrate his birthday on the 4th of July, marking the event with a parade through the MGM studio lot. The anti-Sinclair campaign, estimated to have cost between $2 and $10 million, escalated.
Everywhere you looked, there was anti-Sinclair material, but we always dismissed it because when it came to actually counting people, the pro-Sinclair epic forces could outnumber any anti-Sinclair forces. So we thought that anything that we read that was anti was just somebody with money.
For weeks, newspapers played up Sinclair's remark about the unemployed coming to California.
Ladies and gentlemen, your inquiring cameraman decided to look into this much-discussed situation of the unemployed of the United States flocking to California.
We went to this movie, and sitting there in the regular seats in the audience, and they ran the newsreel. Then, lo and behold, came this segment showing bums getting off of the freight trains in the freight yards in California and someone asking what they were doing.
Your inquiring cameraman interviewed 30, stated that they were on their way to California to spend the winter and to remain there permanently if the epic plan went into effect.
And saying that they were coming there because of Upton Sinclair's campaign, well, that enraged me. So I got up in the middle of the performance. It was dark, of course, and I yelled, I like my movies without propaganda.
There's no excuse for poverty in a state as rich as California. We can produce so much food that we have to dump it into our bays.
Times are soon common. All business will be common, and we'll give all poverty the air. If this epic plan is phony, then the rest is all baloney. So vote for Downey and Upton Sinclair.
You know, we've had a lot of chances in this country to straighten it out. But every time they've been undercut by the predatory capitalists and their Jew friends. As you heard there, that Upton Sinclair was really headed to be the governor of California. And Louis B. Mayer, the Jew, put tremendous amounts of money into propaganda to defeat white socialists, really. And I'm sure they were all nationalists, so I would refer to the population at that time as national white socialists. Yeah. A little bit of history there. Don't forget it. Anything that attempts to straighten problems out in this country will be undercut by the predatory capitalists if they can at all. Well, let's go back in history. This today on Saturday, we're sort of laid back here in the bunker and look into a man you've probably never heard his name. His name is Homer Lay, soldier of fortune. Quite a story about this man, especially prior to 1900. So, let's listen in.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. I'd like to give you a pretty quick overview about why you might be interested in reading my book. And you'll know a lot more about Homer Lay in 20 minutes than you do right now if you don't know about him already. If you enjoy reading biographies of people who help shape world events, I can guarantee you you'll enjoy reading about the exploits of Homer Lay, an American soldier of fortune. His life was stranger than that found in romantic fiction. He earned an international reputation as a man of mystery. He was a soldier of fortune, a writer, and a geopolitical strategist. And since his death in 1912, he's pretty much been an orphan of history. During his lifetime, he was very prominent. He was well known, had an international reputation, and he actually did influence events of the time and help shape some world events after his death. I'd like to give you just a quick overview of how his career is divided up. Part of it had to do with working with the Chinese in Asia. Part of it had to do with being a writer. So first and foremost, the Chinese piece. Homer Lee was a 5'3" hunchback, very bright, and he loved reading military history. And in 1899, he was a student at Stanford University. And with his disability, he figured he would have a career in law. He had an adventurous spirit, and he saw opportunities that many of his colleagues didn't, and he actually took advantage of some of those. And what I mean by that is that the fellow on the left there, Kang Youwei, was the principal advisor to the Emperor of China in 1898, when the Emperor instituted a number of westernized reforms, some of which did away with foot binding, for instance. And Kang Youwei wanted to help westernize China and advance it and bring it forward and modernize it. There was a huge conservative backlash in China, and the Dowager Empress had a palace coup and placed the Emperor Kuangxu under arrest. Okay, that's fine, Chinese politics. Kang Youwei left with a price on his head, established a Chinese society called the Protect the Emperor Association, or the Pao Huang Hui. It had branches all over the world where there were overseas Chinese to solicit money. And he was going to launch a large-scale military operation in China to free the emperor and restore him to power. Now, in 1899, when a branch of this organization was established in San Francisco, Homer Lee heard about it, was interested, and approached the Chinese. He told them he was a brilliant military strategist, but foremost, more importantly, he told them he was a relative of Robert E. Lee. And they thought that was wonderful. Here's this American strategist with great credentials. He was not a relative of Robert E. Lee. And they hired him to help organize and train this ramshackle army they were putting together in China. In the summer of 1900, Homer Lee went to China. He got a lieutenant general's commission in this army, which was not really a formal army by today's standards, and wandered around China. He didn't really accomplish much. And this coincided with the Boxer Rebellion, so there was a lot of discord and activity in China. The Pao Huang Hui's military venture was crushed by the imperial government. Homer Lee left China, came back to the United States, but continued working with the Chinese. Next step, instead of going back to China and leading a resurrected force of a new military force over there, he set up a training scheme in America, a covert training plan across American cities, across the nation. Over 2,000 Chinese joined military schools. And in reality, it was a very thin veil for training a covert army. The schools were supposed to teach conventional English, math, social studies, and this, that, and the other. But in reality, they just drilled, and they had drill instructors that were former soldiers from the U.S. Army. They bought uniforms for this army. They outfitted themselves in uniforms that looked very similar to U.S. Army uniforms, and they simply swapped out the eagle on the cap for a dragon and the eagle on the buttons for a dragon. Other than that, they looked like they're U.S. Army soldiers. Well, the Emperor of China died in 1908, and Homer Lee's training scheme came to the attention of the public. There were some investigations. That kind of fell through. His next effort involved a conspiracy with Dr. Young Wing, the person in the middle, one of the most distinguished Chinese in America at the time, the first graduate of Yale University from China, sponsored numerous Chinese coming to America for education, a former Chinese minister to the United States. He believed in reform. So Homer Lee and company put together what's called the Red Dragon Conspiracy, a conspiracy with Young Wing and several other Chinese and some American businessmen to launch a revolution to carve out two provinces in southern China to make their own republic, Kuangsung and Kuangxi provinces. Absolutely incredible. They approached American businessmen for funding and finance. Too risky a proposal. Well, it just so happened that Homer Lee turned to his talents to being an author. In 1909, he wrote a very successful book discussing American defense and principally how the Japanese might invade some American possessions in Asia, in the Pacific, and possibly attack California. I'll talk about that book a little bit later. It's called The Valor of Ignorance. The book came out in 1909 to rave reviews, and in 1910, when the Red Dragon Conspiracy was foundering, Homer Lee, the author, with a great international reputation, linked up through the offices of Yuen Wing with the revolutionary on the right, Dr. Sun Yat-sen. He wanted to overthrow the entire Manchu dynasty and take control of all of China. Had a number of revolutionary attempts under his belt that had failed. Homer Lee became Dr. Sun Yat-sen's principal foreign advisor. In the summer, in the fall of 1911, actually it's the anniversary of this month in October. October 10th of 1911, the revolution started that actually would overthrow the Manchu dynasty in a few months. Sun Yat-sen returned to China in late 1911 to become the first president of the Chinese Republic. Beyond their wildest dreams, they were going to get their republic. Sun Yat-sen, instead of going to China directly, Sun Yat-sen was in America at the time, in Colorado. He could have just gone to California, taken a ship to China. Didn't do that. Homer Lee was in Wiesbaden, Germany at the time, getting medical treatment for his eyes. He cabled Homer Lee. You've got the international connections. Go to London, contact Washington, get us funding. We need funding for this new revolution. Get the Americans and the British to back this. Homer Lee met Sun Yat-sen in London, and from there, they were unsuccessful in getting Western financial backing. But when Homer Lee went on the ship to China with Sun Yat-sen, he had every expectation of becoming the chief of staff of the new Chinese army. That's what he was promised. Now, here's somebody with no formal military experience. He had a military uniform that made him look like a general. He had written a book that talked about geopolitics and strategy and defending American possessions. But now he was on the verge of capping his career with something of Napoleonic stature. He got to China, and the American State Department told him in no uncertain terms, as an American national, he could not be the head of the Chinese army. So while he was somewhat embittered about this, his failing health came back to intervene, I should say. And in February, he suffered a severe stroke. Well, he went back to California with every expectation of regaining his health and rejoining Sun Yat-sen. Sun Yat-sen, by this time, had given up the presidency to avoid a civil war and let a Chinese general take over the presidency. But Homer Lee died in November of 1912. So that phase of his career was pretty short-lived. He had reached the pinnacle of his desires and goals to be a real general of a real army. He came very, very close. And along the way, he embarked on a number of different ventures with Chinese reformers and revolutionaries. As you can see here, these are just some photos of Homer Lee in various military and pseudo-military garb. The one on the left is when he came back from China right after the Boxer Rebellion, a rather youthful fellow in his mid-early 20s. The middle photo, taken around 1904, 1905, he would have been around 25 or 26. So taken at the same time as the photo on the right in the military uniform. That's an American Lieutenant General's uniform, simply removing the eagles and replacing them with dragons. So this photo was in the press all over the country. If you didn't know any better, you'd think he was an American military officer. A similar photo to that was in both of his books. You had no reason to believe that he wasn't a legitimate officer, albeit a very young-looking one. There's a photo of some troops training in Los Angeles in broad daylight, some of the Chinese troops there. And the fellow in the white shirt is that you see on the right there, at that time held a commission in the California militia. He used to be a member of the 4th Cavalry Regiment. That's where Homer Lee drew upon members of the 4th Cavalry Regiment out of Fort Riley after they demobilized from the Spanish-American War and the Philippine Insurrection. They were hired to be his drill instructors. So in this case, Ansel O'Banion actually got a militia commission in California. That's Ansel O'Banion in the white shirt. Well, this was supposed to be a covert operation. And actually, people in the American government knew about it. Homer Lee had met President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt kind of gave a tacit wink to this training scheme. But various elements of the government and state and local governments did investigate this. And much to the chagrin of Homer Lee and company, when this headline came out, that was the very last thing they wanted, was this kind of exposure. So So that really helped close down this covert military training operation with front page headlines like that. Well, the other part of his career, as I just indicated, had to do with Homer Lee as a writer. Now, I don't know about you all here, this is my first book, and I'm very proud to have done it, and I put a lot of work into it. And I have several advanced degrees that show that I know what I'm doing. Not the case with Homer Lee. After he came back from China, his college dropout, in addition to working with the Chinese, decided he wanted to be an author. So this book, The Vermilion Pencil, was published in 1908. It's his first book. He got it published. It was considered at the time a really good read, an exciting romance about China. And at the time, it was considered the first novel written about China. This was one of the very few Westerners that would come in and write a novel. Most people in America that went to China were mining engineers or missionaries. They're not writing spicy novels with people's wives running off with mandarins and the like, and that's what this was about. So these three books, which I'm going to talk about in turn, were his major works. The Vermilion Pencil, there were plans actually to make that into a stage play. That kind of fell through. But after Homer Lee's death, it actually was made into a silent film in 1922. That kind of grainy photo you see on the right, that Sessu Hayakawa, the Japanese actor-producer, this was one of his key films. And there's an American actress with him by his side. Okay, so his first book became popular, they made it into a movie. Well, this is his crowning achievement. This 1909 book catapulted Homer Lee into fame beyond his wildest dreams as an author. This is what he's most known for. This is the book that goes way beyond his life, his legacy. This is the one I'll talk about a little more in detail. When he was living in California, trying to get some of his Chinese schemes going, he was involved with several influential California businessmen. They, in turn, knew some pretty influential former Army officers. Lieutenant General Adna Chaffee, the former Chief of Staff of the Army, retired in Los Angeles. And so did Major General Joseph Story, depicted on the right as a colonel, but that's him. He was the former Chief of Artillery. They both wrote glowing introductions to The Valor of Ignorance. With those introductions, if you wore a U.S. Army uniform, you wanted to read this book. If you were stationed out in the Philippines in particular, you wanted to read this book because it had theoretical plans and maps of how to invade the Philippines. From 1909 until Pearl Harbor, just about every officer in the U.S. Army worth his salt knew about this book and read this book. General MacArthur and the staff went to school on this book. General MacArthur credited Homer Lee and this book with helping him formulate policies for defending the Philippines. This book was significant. Well, Homer Lee dedicated it to Secretary of War Root on the lower left there. He met Root once. And in Washington, California Congressman James McLachlan was using the book and holding it up in the halls of Washington, saying that we've got some really defensive insecurity to the West Coast. And so the book inspired the Army to relook at defense. It inspired the Army to put on some war games about how would you defend against a potential Japanese invasion. People from the Army War College started consulting with Homer Lee on putting war games together. And Homer Lee's book was just considered a new Bible, if you will, for people in America concerned about defense. Now, for those of you who are familiar with geopolitical writing at the time, Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan, the naval writer in the 1890s, the influence of sea power, wrote the first really geopolitical book about defending America's interests militarily. Well, that's about the Navy. Homer Lee wrote his geopolitical book really about land warfare. So this is the next big connect-the-dots geopolitical book in American history. This is a game changer. It's very influential. The Japanese went to school on this. The Germans read it. Europeans read it. Very influential. Well, as I said, the Japanese read this. I don't have a lot of citations from the Japanese, just a few bits and pieces in my book. But I can tell you, the feeling is that everybody in the Japanese high command that fought in World War II knew who Homer Lee was and read his book. And the Japanese did start taking seriously the Americans as a theoretical adversary in 1909. That's documented. That's the same year this book came out. Well, it just so happens, as I mentioned earlier, General MacArthur and his staff read the book. But by chance, the journalist Claire Booth Luce, who was married to the publisher of Time Life magazine, was out visiting the Philippines before Pearl Harbor, a year before. And she was being entertained by a story by the head of General MacArthur's intelligence, Colonel Charles Willoughby. He was telling her at the officers' club they had just arrested some Filipino boy because he was sending secret war plans to some friend somewhere. And he was explaining to her that it really wasn't the war plans, that after they found out that he had checked Homer Lee's book out of the library and just copied them out. And so that's how close some of our planning was. And so Claire Booth Luce became enamored by Homer Lee. She just thought he was wonderful. She came back to America, and after Pearl Harbor, she single-handedly resurrected this man into a military prophet. She wrote some articles in the Saturday Evening Post, and next thing you know, he's all over the papers. This is the guy that saw it coming. This is the guy that said the Japanese were going to do this. And oh, by the way, his plans, as I may have indicated, for the invasion of the Philippines was very similar to what the Japanese actually did. So he really earned high marks as a forgotten military prophet. And Claire Booth Luce, from that time on, was enamored by him. And she actually wrote the basis of a screenplay. There were several efforts to write movies about Homer Lee. Well, The Valor of Ignorance was so popular in England, the former head of the British Army, Field Marshal Lord Roberts, shown on the left, bought every copy that Harper and Brothers published in England. He bought them all. All the ones that he could get his hands on in London. I shouldn't say in England. In London, he bought them all, and he handed them out to everybody he knew in government. And then he wrote Homer Lee saying, would you please write something for the British similar to what you've written in America? That's the book, The Day of the Saxon. Homer Lee wrote this. He consulted with Field Marshal Lord Roberts. They wrote a little bit back and forth to each other. And this book really didn't take the interest of the Japanese. It took the interest of the Germans, who were going to be the adversaries with the British. So this book was translated into German. The Kaiser loved it. The Kaiser loved The Valor of Ignorance. And Homer Lee had himself a real international reputation, as I indicated, as a writer. Well, okay, so Homer Lee dies in 1912. Sun Yat-sen is going to battle on and off for control in China until he dies in the 1920s. Homer Lee's books go out of print. He gets resurrected during World War II. And Homer Lee, meanwhile, had his ashes. He was cremated. So his family keeps his ashes. In his will, he left that he wanted to be buried in China. His wife never made any effort that I know of with Sun Yat-sen to have his ashes taken to China before Sun Yat-sen died. And then the wife, she died in 1934. She was cremated. Her son kept the ashes, so he had the ashes. And he never had enough money or wherewithal to go to China to move the ashes to China. Well, in 1949, the China mainland became communist, so the idea of taking Homer Lee back to mainland, that's a wash. That wasn't going to happen. So when certain of Homer Lee's papers were donated to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in late 1968, one of the conditions of donating the papers by the family is, can you please arrange to have Homer Lee's ashes taken to China? Well, the mainland was out of the question. But for those of you who know or don't know this, Chiang Kai-shek was Sun Yat-sen's brother-in-law. Chiang Kai-shek knew Homer Lee. So when the government was approached in Taiwan for possibly taking the ashes, they bring them over. This is great. So it was a big ceremony, a big military ceremony to take Homer Lee's ashes. They're currently interred in Taiwan. And the plan at the time, at least according to Chiang Kai-shek, is that when the two Chinas were reunited, then the ashes, he would take the ashes over to the mainland. As it stands, of course, the Chiang Kai-shek is long since gone. And Homer Lee's family would very much like to see Homer Lee's ashes taken back to the mainland. So, with that said, that's my quick overview of Homer Lee in the book. And if you're interested in someone like that who shaped world events, well, although he's been largely forgotten since then, I would recommend it. Now, what I want to also add is this. Mine is the second book ever published about Homer Lee. The fact that the first was written in the 1980s and the author has since died, that book was a good starting point, and it used the papers that were donated to the Hoover Institution. Prior to the 1960s, there was never enough material to even think about writing a scholarly biography of Homer Lee. So I've been working on this off and on for a number of years, and where my book transcends and bypasses the one in the 80s is I have the advantage of having used sources from the internet. So each week that goes by, each month that goes by, like low-picking fruit, new material may come to the forefront. I've also had the advantage of running into some of Homer Lee's family members who have shared some information with me. Now, I'd like to give you just a quick anecdote about the trials and tribulations of writing about this. When Homer Lee was alive, he was called an international man of mystery for a reason. There was so much misrepresentation and exaggeration about who he was and what he did when he was alive, it was near impossible to separate the fact from the fiction. That was a huge historical task. Here's just a quick anecdote. I was fortunate enough to get some letters that Homer Lee's sister wrote for an article in the 1940s for Life magazine that was never published, talking about some aspects of his life. And his sister wrote about how he was involved in it. He was going to have a duel, fight a duel, right before his first book came out. Well, I just showed you on the chart there, his first book came out in 1908. So I looked through the newspapers that I had access to from California, from Los Angeles at the time, Los Angeles Times, could find nothing about a duel. And I figured, well, okay, he must have done this in early 1908. He's going to fight this duel. So I wrote that section into my manuscript. I had information nobody had ever seen before. I was going to corner the market on new, authoritative Homer Lee information. And then a few months later, the Library of Congress, which is digitizing newspapers as we speak, digitized the Los Angeles Herald. Lo and behold, I see a front page story on Homer Lee having a duel. But it's in 1906, not 1908. And it had really nothing to do with the sister's recollection. Her memory was completely skewed. It was off. So it gives you pause for reflection that you want to use authoritative sources and documents. And in this case, I determined that the newspaper published the day after the event was much more authoritative and accurate than the sister's memory 40 years later. But it's an example of those challenges of sorting through the myth of Homer Lee. If you were to go on the web or read any article to date, anything published about Homer Lee, a certain percentage of it is going to be inaccurate and wrong. Case closed. Case closed. That's the challenge. This book here, at least as far as I can tell, is the most accurate and authoritative biography of Homer Lee. And so I will entertain any questions or comments if anybody has any at this point.
Pacific-wide theater view invasion, was it just an academic exercise on his part, or did he envision himself as the great savior in response to it? I mean, what precipitated that?
Good question. What I did not answer earlier is Homer Lee being a real student of world events. It was the Russo-Japanese War. The Japanese fought the Russians in 1904 and 1905, and as soon as that war was over, Homer Lee understood, especially with his Asian contacts and connections, where the path of Japanese expansionism was leading. Now, for those of you that don't have encyclopedic memories of Japanese history, in 1894 and 1895, there was the Sino-Japanese War, where the Japanese fought the Chinese, and that was really the start for Japanese expansionism. 10 years later, the Japanese fought the Russians. And Homer Lee simply just connected the dots and saw this was going across the Pacific. Homer Lee also was a social Darwinist. He believed in survival of the fittest, and he believed in preserving the Anglo-Saxon race. His view, global view, was we've got to keep American and British ties together. And he saw China as a counterbalance weight to Japanese and Russian expansionism in Asia. So he saw the British and the Americans formulating this bond with China as a counterweight. And he did see things geopolitically because he was a student of the Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War and global events. Next, any other questions, comments?
Well, that might have been a little surprise to you at the end there. Here's a little guy, 5 foot tall, hunchback, probably not that handsome to look at. If there was a white supremacist, he was a white supremacist and looked upon the world from that point of view. And so here's another one. to put up in your memory file. What a life. What a story. And people still do it today. I mean, there's no hooks into a young man that wants to travel the world, see everything, and look it over. I remember John Jewell, who edited our war newspaper for some time. He went to, after he got out of the Vietnam situation, he went to he went over to North Africa, and he traveled all the way from the west northern Mediterranean coast, all the way through the Atlas Mountains, and all the way to the east. He walked, and when you walk, you learn a hell of a lot. You learn a hell of a lot about the people over there. So young people, certain young people still do it. And so here was Homer Lee, pretty young man when he did all this, you know. Think about it. If you're anywhere from 16 to 25, and you're not all hooked up and married with kids and stuff, hell, the world's your oyster. Go to it. Soldier of fortune, but maybe not soldier. A person of fortune. It's not that hard to travel, not that expensive to travel if you know how. 14-5. Terrible Tommy is off and clear. And I'll be back with you on Moon's Day.
If your truck is stuck in a rut, you don't sit there crying. Just start it back up and you kick it into gear. Yeah, y'all. Show up to the dance, I won't see some dancing. Shake it till it break or sit it down in a chair. So get it started out slow. To me, way back, then you go with the flow. But I know everybody's gonna spin and cheer. Then you can get in the gear. If you're sitting in with the band, you got to get with it. Every lick you're picking, you got to be sincere. And if you're ready to prove, you can rock the lobby right into the roof. People gonna be waiting, just waiting to hear. You can get in the gear.
Yeah.